Welcome to the United States Institute of Peace. My name is Susan Hayward, and I am a program officer in the Religion and Peacemaking Program. And I'm very glad to have all of you here for what has turned out to be a very timely discussion on the political situation in Sri Lanka. Just by way of anecdote, when we first set up this meeting about a month and a half ago, it had originally been called Pulling Back from the Brink of War. Unfortunately, given the circumstances over the past month, the title changed, as has, I would assume, the tone and some of the perspectives that we'll offer in our presentations. Before we get started, I would like to ask that you turn off your cell phones, pagers, Blackberries, anything that beeps or chirps or rings, and actually not just putting it on to vibrate, but turning it all the way off because it does interfere with our sound system. And we're recording this for the website, so I'd appreciate that. And with that, we can begin. 2008 has not begun well for Sri Lanka. Following 2 years of escalating violence, 2007 culminated in bombings in the capital of Colombo that killed roughly 20 individuals, mostly civilians. This trajectory carried into the new year, with assassinations taking the lives of several parliamentarians. Military battles fought between government forces and the liberation tigers of Tamil Eelam in the northern part of the country have likewise increased. On January 2nd, the government of Sri Lanka announced that it would pull out of the Norwegian brokered ceasefire agreement signed in 2002. The move was an acknowledgement of reality, at least, given that both sides had demonstrated their lack of commitment to the CFA by increasing retaliatory attacks in recent years. Indeed, the Scandinavian Sri Lanka monitoring mission had announced at the end of 2007 that the level of violence countrywide had reached pre-CFA levels. And many, inside and outside of Sri Lanka, had grown increasingly cynical as both sides paid lip service to the agreements, yet pursued military actions that were clearly in violation of it. Still, the announcement deflated the hopes of many observers of Sri Lanka's conflict, who resolutely believed or hoped that the CFA and the Norwegian process could be used as leverage to pressure the two sides to step back from the brink of warfare and recommit to a process already in place to find a political solution to the 25-year-old violent conflict. While the government has publicly insisted that it has not decided to wage war and that it remains willing to hold talks with Tamil parties, and for its part, the LTTE has issued statements saying it remains committed to the CFA, the reality on the ground indicates that both sides seem bound to pursue retaliatory attacks that look, sound, and feel like a resumption of war. This afternoon, I am delighted to welcome here to USIP two experts on the Sri Lankan conflict, Ambassador Teresita Schaefer and Dr. Sanli Samarasinghe, to speak to some of the internal and external factors that have contributed to Sri Lanka's current troubling situation. We will also discuss what might be done to halt the current violence and what leverage points exist, if any, to convince the two parties to re-engage in political negotiations. I will wait to introduce my panelists more in full until it's their turn to speak. And for now, I'm going to start off by offering an overview of some of the recent political developments in Sri Lanka that led to the disintegration of the CFA and the government's decision to abrogate from the agreement. As many of you, I'm sure, know, Sri Lanka's current civil war dates back to the early 1980s when the Tamil insurgency group, the LTTE, took up arms with the intent to create a separate state in the north and eastern provinces of the island. As argued by the LTTE, the separate state was necessary in order to protect the political rights of the Tamil minority against the central government and majority Sinhala population it had deemed incapable of so doing through the parliamentary process. To date, the conflict has taken the lives of over 70,000 people. Over 4,000 of these casualties have occurred in the last 3 years. The conflict has been marked by brutal acts of violence, including mass forced displacement. LTTE conducted suicide bombings that have targeted civilians as well as security forces. child recruitment, disappearances, and social and political backlash against minority populations. Attempts at peace negotiations over the years, which have included several rounds of direct bilateral talks and a coercive attempt by India to implement a negotiated agreement in the late 80s, have failed to end the increasingly complex and now deeply protracted conflict. The most recent peace process, in which Norway has served as a third-party mediator, backed by European Union, United States, and Japan, who have offered economic carrots to encourage the process forward, now appears the most recent casualty in Sri Lanka's graveyard of peace efforts. There are many, myriad, numerous factors at play that have contributed to the conflict's protracted nature. And to do justice to all of them would require a much longer workshop than we have scheduled for today. But I would like to touch upon several political developments that have recently transpired that I believe have directly contributed to the government's decision to withdraw from the ceasefire agreement on January 2nd. To begin with was the lack of progress on the peace process. The signing of the CFA in 2002 was interpreted as a hopeful sign for the future of a successful peace process. Ideally, the agreement was to be a means to build trust between the parties so that they could begin to tackle some of the more difficult questions of power sharing and devolution of power. The agreement included various confidence-building measures to be carried out in order to build this trust and create this environment, including freedom of movement between the North and the South. In the space provided by the cessation of violence in its early years, many displaced populations returned home and began to rebuild their lives. And in negotiations that followed the CFA, the LTTE dropped its demands for a separate state and began to explore federal solutions in concert with the government. These were hopeful signs, demonstrating the utility of the CFA, even as some of its weaknesses became apparent. Unfortunately, significant political progress failed to follow. Talks increasingly ended in deadlock as both sides presented power-sharing solutions the other found to be entirely unacceptable. This led the LTTE to withdraw from talks in 2003. While the government struggled to put together a political proposal for power sharing acceptable to the LTTE that would also find wide and necessary support from the many parties within the parliament, substantive talks failed to resume. As talks failed to gain traction or depth, violence increased island-wide, and inflammatory rhetoric on both sides were ramped up. On the fourth anniversary of the CFA, Tigerhead Prabhakaran announced that the LTTE would resume their campaign to achieve their own state. On several occasions, government officials publicly expressed their own intention to resume military campaigns in order to find a final defeat of the LTTE. As a result of these developments, trust between the parties was further eroded, making the implementation of further confidence-building measures stipulated in the CFA and continued negotiations an increasingly uphill battle. Indeed, actionable steps that had been taken seemed to backslide. For example, the A9 road that links Jaffna with the south that had been opened as stipulated by the CFA was closed in the summer of 2006. Number two, Mahinda Rajapaksa's election in the new ruling UPFA coalition. In 2005, as talks increasingly failed to move forward, Sri Lanka Freedom Party presidential candidate Mahinda Rajapaksa ran against United National Party candidate Ranil Wickremesinghe's pro-peace platform, with one that was widely interpreted to advocate a more hard-line approach to the conflict. With the support of nationalist groups such as the Marxist JBP and the Monk-led JHU, and buoyed by a Tamil boycott of the election in the LTTE-controlled areas, Rajapaksa won the very tight presidential race. Following his elections, bombings in the north blamed on the LTTE and the group's closure of the Mavialaru water reservoir supply to local populations in the east provoked reaction from the government and Sinhala nationalist parties. presently, the nationalist parties who helped to ensure Rajapaksa's victory appear to have found success in their lobbying of administrative officials and the general public, particularly in the South, to oppose negotiations with the Tigers and encourage a renewed military solution to preserve a unitary state. The increased central influence of these nationalist parties and their hardline positions does not bode well for a resumption of peace talks or a substantive political process to address root causes of the conflict. However, I do want to balance this pessimistic assertion with a note of optimism, for I believe that it's Rajapaksa's working relationships with these parties that simultaneously provide the potential for him to corral agreement amongst the various Southern Sinhala parties for a political solution, should he choose to do so. In the past, it has been just this lack of Southern intra-Sinhala party consensus that has led to the disintegration of peace processes. So this is no small point. Number three, the weakening of the LTTE and the government capture of the Eastern Province. The Tigers have been substantially weakened politically and with regards to resources in recent years, which has given the government newfound hope that it can gain an upper hand. The government appears to believe that at the very least, its continued military assault will further weaken the LTTE and thereby strengthen its own hand at the negotiating table. The most optimistic in the government seem to believe that the military may defeat the insurgency group once and for all. The government's belief that it might be able to bring a final defeat of the Tigers comes as a result of its recent victories in the Eastern Province. The defeat of the Tigers in the East was achieved in part due to an internal split within the insurgency group in 2004 that led top commander Karuna to break away and turn against the rebel group. Gaining control over parts of the Eastern Province, the Karuna faction, widely believed to have government support, began to chip away at the Tigers' hold on the Eastern Province. With the LTTE on the defensive, the government was able to reclaim Tiger strongholds and celebrated its capture of the East this past July with celebrations in Colombo. Following the capture, Karuna escaped Sri Lanka and has now traveled to the UK, where he's currently being held by authorities there. The Tigers have also been weakened by international condemnation of their terrorist tactics, particularly suicide and roadside bombs that have targeted civilians, child recruitment, and intimidation and harassment of local and diaspora communities. Following September 11th, numerous countries blacklisted the LTTE as a terrorist organization and have taken steps to obstruct diaspora community funding from reaching them in Sri Lanka. The increased lack of sympathy for the LTTE and a decrease in its outside funding have hurt the Tigers' position and further emboldened the Sri Lankan government. Given these changes, the political and military balance of power has been greatly altered from that which existed when they signed the ceasefire agreement in 2002. As a result, both sides are less willing to adhere to the framework laid out in that agreement. Finally, I'd like to speak about the increasingly insecure environment. The security situation in Sri Lanka has gone downhill recently, as many of the familiar acts of violence that have marked the conflict in the past have reemerged. These include political assassinations, disappearances, bombings, and military campaigns that have displaced and or killed thousands of civilians. The Tigers have been blamed for a number of successful and attempted assassinations of political figures. As in the past, politicians targeted have largely been Tamil politicians deemed too close to the central government. The latter includes Foreign Minister Lakshman Kadirgamar, who was assassinated in 2005, leading the Kumaratunga government to reinstate emergency rule, which has been extended since that time. High-ranking LTTE members have also been felled by government military operations, including the head of its political wing, S.P. Thomasovan, and its head intelligence officer very recently. Two LTTE sympathetic MPs were assassinated in 2005 and 2006 as well. Recent events are a testament to the assertion that Sri Lanka is one of the most dangerous places in the world to serve in the government. These assassinations also indicate a further eroding of conditions necessary for effective multi-party cooperative work to be conducted, within the government as a means to address the complex issues that are facing the country. In 2007, the LTTE demonstrated that it had acquired an Air Force to accompany its land and sea operations. The Air Force is rudimentary at best, comprised of only several small aircraft it seems to have smuggled into the country in pieces and assembled. The acquisition of even a rudimentary Air Force is striking, though, in that it reveals that, at least in these latter years of the CFA, the LTTE has used breathing space offered by the agreement to ramp up its military fleet. It has likely done this in order to compensate for its weakened political position and to bolster its ability to target Sinhala-dominated areas in the south. Recently, a great deal of international attention has been brought to bear on Sri Lanka with respect to an increase in violations of human rights. The government, LTTE, and paramilitary groups have all been subject to accusations by Human Rights Watch, Amnesty, and NGOs operating in the eastern and northern provinces. In response, several foreign countries have issued statements of concern and taken measures to pressure all parties to abide by international human rights norms. This includes the United States, which has drastically reduced the overall amount of defense spending that is going to the Sri Lankan government in 2008. Although I would add that there remains room for some assistance in the forms of surveillance and training. There have been several calls for a human rights monitoring body to operate in Sri Lanka, which the government has staunchly opposed, calling it an infringement on its sovereignty. The need for such a monitoring body has become ever more acute with the withdrawal of the Scandinavian monitoring mission this week and its mechanism for objective reporting. With military operations often come human rights violations. If the government hopes to preserve any international support for its war against the LTTE, it will need to demonstrate that it is doing its best to abide by international humanitarian law. Similarly, if the LTTE wishes to generate greater international sympathy for the situation of Tamils in Sri Lanka, it will need to refrain from its own terrorist practices. In a recent positive sign, the High Court of Sri Lanka has passed several rulings that have demonstrated a newfound willingness to impose some curtailment on the government for overstepping legal bounds in its attempt to preserve national security. The court recently ruled that the military must shut down some of the myriad security checkpoints in and around Colombo and criticized the mass detention of Tamils in Colombo following the shopping mall bombing late last year. These rulings are a positive sign that healthy checks and balances can still be found within Sri Lanka governance to help ensure that the pursuit of security does not come at too high a cost to the rule of law. Meanwhile, however, military campaigns continue on several fronts in Manar and the northern Wani region, which have displaced the new local populations. I fear that the government's abrogation of the CFA will lead to an escalation of violent conflict in the coming months. The snowball of retaliatory violence has picked up considerable speed, and its momentum at this point may be unstoppable. One final issue I'd like to address briefly before I end is the decreasing space for civil society functioning in Sri Lanka. My own background in the country has been several years of affiliation with the humanitarian and peacebuilding NGO sector. Recently, many of my colleagues in this realm have reported an increased obstructionist scrutiny on their activities and a decrease in their personal security and independence to operate. This includes the media as well as human rights, development, and peacemaking organizations. When I was in Sri Lanka in November, an office of the Leader newspaper, an often outspoken and critical voice, was attacked by arsonists. Reporters Without Borders has reported on assassinations of journalists and an increase in intimidation and threats reporters face from numerous parties. In addition, many in the NGO community, particularly human rights and peacemaking organizations, but including as well UN agencies, have become increasingly, and sometimes unfairly, targeted with criticism and increased government surveillance in legislation. Scrutiny often comes from efforts made by the Parliamentary Select Committee to investigate and monitor NGOs, established following the tsunami when NGOs were accused of fraud and coercive proselytizing. The committee was established and is chaired by the JVP party, traditionally the loudest source of NGO condemnation. Investigations of NGOs to ensure their transparency are essential. But I'm concerned that increasing investigations are being conducted in a bullying or partisan manner that hinders the effectiveness of reputable organizations to contribute to the common good, and further impedes the ability of vulnerable populations in the North and the East to receive humanitarian assistance that they increasingly need in order to survive. Moreover, or more broadly, a healthy civil society is vital to a representative democracy. And a representative democracy is in turn necessary for a future peace process to enjoy buy-in and legitimacy among the Sri Lankan population. As a final thought, I would say that it's hard to be optimistic when looking at current events in Sri Lanka. The wind has more than left the sails of the peace process. Violence is on the rise and will likely continue to rise in 2008. If history is any indication, the likely outcome of Sri Lanka's return to war will be a military stalemate that will force the parties back to the table. Although the government may feel emboldened by its victories in the east, it is unlikely to find similar success in the north, where the LTTE stronghold is much, where the LTTE hold is much stronger. Nearly all observers have repeatedly stated that the ethnic conflicts and grievances of minority communities in Sri Lanka cannot be solved through military means, but only through a renewed, engaged, and widely supported political process that can address root causes. We'll now turn the microphone over to my colleagues to discuss what might be done internally and externally to help encourage this sort of political process along. We will begin with Dr. Stanley Samarasinghe, who currently serves as director of the Tulane Institute for International Development here in Washington, D.C. Dr. Samarasinghe earned his Ph.D. in economics from the University of Cambridge in 1980 and has taught at the University of Peradeniya in Sri Lanka. He currently serves as one of the directors of the International Center for Ethnic Studies in Sri Lanka, a preeminent think tank there, and has consulted for several Sri Lankan and international organizations. His research interests include macroeconomic policy, health economics, and ethnic conflict. Dr. Samarasinghe has recently returned from a visit to Sri Lanka just on Tuesday and has agreed to speak further about internal political and economic dynamics impacting the Sri Lankan conflict and peace process.
Thank you, Sus.
This works very nicely.
Yep. Okay. I'm pleased to be here this afternoon, and I've been told that I have about 15 minutes in which to make a few comments. Perhaps what I'll do is I'll raise a couple of questions and give my own perspective, and then I'm sure this probably will lead to discussion. By way of background, since I have an economics background, I want to make a brief comment on the economy, because the economy and the war and the the general conditions of the population as well as their attitude towards war or peace is partly conditioned by economic situation. And in the Sri Lankan case, in the recent past, a great deal has been spoken about the increasing military budget, and that's very true. The 2008 budget is expected to be around $1.7 billion in a $22 billion economy. So that's a large amount. And in fact, if you look at the military expenditure figures from the mid-1990s, you can see from mid-1990s to around 2000-2001, before the CFA, the military expenditure was somewhere in the order of about 17% to 20% of the government total expenditure. And it slipped to below 15% during the time of the ceasefire agreement. And now again, it's up, going up. The results of the very heavy government expenditure partly explains the high rate of inflation that the country is now exposed to, but it's obviously not only attributable to fiscal policy, but it's also partly imported inflation. Nevertheless, the fact of the matter is that there is an inflationary tax imposed on the consumers of Sri Lanka, partly to finance the budget deficit. But what is interesting is that there are two points to be remembered. the predicted collapse of the economy seems not to occur. In the year 2000, we know that there was a recession, but that was due to very unusual circumstances. In fact, the unusual thing about the Sri Lankan economy is that over a period of 20 to 30 years, while a war has raged in a part of the country, the economy has been, you know, kind of it's up and down all right, but it has sustained itself, which is rather unusual, because in most cases you would find the economy eventually collapsing, but not in the Sri Lankan case. One of the reasons is the significant structural change that occurred since the liberalization, so that the government has taken its hands off the good part of the economy. So the private sector, from the smallest farmer to the biggest corporation in Sri Lanka, they just get on with the job of whatever they produce, whatever they do. Of course, there are certain specific sectors that get affected more badly when the violence increases, for example, the tourist sector. But on the other hand, there are so many other sectors, including the export sector, which almost now sort of carries on regardless. And that's an important point to remember. And secondly, of course, those of us who visit Sri Lanka from abroad tend to pick up their information largely from the urban community of Colombo. But Sri Lanka is not an exclusively an urban country. It's largely more rural country. And the impact of the war and even inflation on the rural community would be very significantly different to that of the urban community. And therefore, one should never judge the Sri Lankan mood by simply going and talking to people in Colombo and rushing to conclusions. But that's only by way of background. But let me, four or five, you know, sort of questions I want to raise with you this afternoon are the following. One, there's this big question, and even Susan raised it, and in fact she came down, shall we say, on the negative side. Will the war be won? That's a big question that Sri Lankans are asking. A second question that the Sri Lankans want to know is, what have we learned from the past peace process? And if by any chance the war is won, what do you do after that? You see, I mean, that's a big question too. And can there be a sudden consensus, either for the waging of the war, but more particularly for a post-war settlement, whether it is after completely destroying the LTT, as the government hopes, or after a stalemate. One way or the other, it's very, very clear from past experiences, the peace process, that there needs to be some kind of sudden consensus for a sustained peace settlement to occur. And then there's the whole issue of what can be done if whatever the reason is, if the violence stops, whether it is because the government wins or whether there's a stalemate, what do you do about after that? And finally, what are the special, you know, considerations of the East in particular and the Muslim community? That is because the Sri Lankan conflict is so much pivoted on the situation in the Eastern province. That's a fact, because of this ethnic mix that you find in the Eastern province. Let me start off by trying to answer the question about the military campaign that is currently going on. You see, when you look at the current military campaign and compare it with previous ones, particularly the one where you may recall what is called the Vadamarachi operation, where the Indian government intervened and stopped what could have been a fairly difficult situation for the LTT, there are two significant differences today. Compared to, shall we say, the campaigns in the 80s and the 90s. On the part of the Sri Lanka government, the military goals and the political goals seems to be one and the same. So that there is no kind of, currently at least, a stop-go policy. You see, in other words, the politicians do not order the generals to start the war and then say, now stop, because, you know, we have some other agenda. And this has been the case in the past. But this time, the generals have been told, that's what we have to first achieve. Now, whether you like it or not, whether you know the violence and so on, that's a different issue. But very, very clearly, the political leadership has told the military leadership, win the war. And so far, over the last 18 to 24 months, that has been the case. There is no wavering from that objective, despite international criticism. That's one point. The second point is the position that India would take. I mean, clearly, in 1987, what happened was that the Indians intervened and said, this far and no more. You can't proceed beyond this. But this time it is not at all clear that the Indians would actually intervene if there is success in the North. It's not at all clear. I do not know, I am not privy to diplomatic communications, what kind of, you see, diplomatic hints or communications are being passed between Delhi and Colombo. But my own hunch is that the Indians are not going to send their military planes if there is actually a serious threat to the viability of the, shall we say, the Kilinochchi LTT administration. And that's a very significant difference that we need to recognize in trying to assess the final outcome of the current military campaign. Now from there, let me ask the question, what have we learned from the past peace process? Because that is relevant to whatever the outcome is. Because if you want to achieve peace, you need to understand what went wrong the last time. My own interpretation there is that in the, shall we call it, the Vikramasinghe CFA, the 2002-2004 period in particular, I think what happened was that there was this sort of feeling in the majority community that it was too focused on the minorities. You see, I recall during that period, there was this, you know, sort of sense of, you know, do we have, you know, almost I felt that the self-confidence of the Sinhalese was being, you know, sort of undermined. And there was this phenomenon of what was called Somahanduru, a monk who became very prominent and became a public preacher during that period. And he was quite militant in his, and he had a huge following. Now, of course, he has been forgotten, more or less. But during that period, I got the impression that the Sinhalese psyche was, my gosh, we are isolated from, you know, we don't have any supporters in the world. That kind of psychology was in the country. Now, the point I'm trying to make is that in any post-war, whether after stalemate or after a government victory or whatever, settlement, it's terribly important to consider the concerns of all the ethnic communities and not only those of the minorities. Because if you reflect on Vikramasinghe's performance in the last presidential election, discounting the boycott of the Tamil voters in parts of the North and the East as a result of maybe LTT intervention, there was definitely a shift in Sinhala opinion towards Vikramasinghe. Because if you look at the parliamentary elections of the previous 2004 parliamentary elections and look at the polls in the South and then compare it with the presidential election, there is no question, with the exception of the South, the southern province, everywhere else there was a swing in favor of Vikramasinghe. That's a fact. All you have to do is to look at the poll numbers. And the swing was not from the minorities. It was primarily on the part of the Sinhalese. Yes?
Just can you take the name again? I couldn't get the name.
I'm sure. Whose name? Mr. Vikramasinghe, the presidential candidate. So in that sense, there is a Sinhala constituency for peace. There's no question about it. But the important thing is, Mr. Rajapaksa succeeded in mobilizing what you might call the anti-CFA constituency among the Sinhalese. Because Mr. Rajapaksa's election victory was almost exclusively a majority community-based victory. Hardly any minority voters supported Mr. Rajapaksa. What it means is that there is still about, I would say, 60% to 70% of the Sinhala population that strongly believes that the LTT is a terrorist organization, that the war is correct, and so on. The 2007 November, just 2 months ago, the last opinion poll that was taken by the CPA shows that 48%, let's say give or take the usual error margin, about half of the Sinhalese population think that the war is a very sensible idea. Half of the people who were polled among the Sinhalese. And so that's a very important point to remember. So in other words, if you are going to have a peaceful settlement, that settlement has to be marketed. That's the point I'm making. Unfortunately, the Vikramasinghe settlement was not marketed at all. It was sort of assumed that people will cheer the government and support the government because killings have stopped. But it didn't work that way. Because there was the anti-CFA people who were marketing their position on this issue. Now from there, I come to the question of can there be a sudden consensus? Now here again, it is dangerous to generalize. For instance, whenever I am in Sri Lanka, and I was in Sri Lanka for a month and I got back, as Susan said, on Tuesday evening, I always make it a point, although sometimes it's extremely boring, to listen to the political talk shows to understand what the current political thinking is. Now, for instance, I was listening to JVP spokespersons very recently, in the last 1 or 2 weeks, and they are consistently the ones who are most against any kind of devolution. No question about it. Very unequivocal about it. But in contrast, those who speak on behalf of the JHU, the monk party, take a more conciliatory view. For instance, one of the spokespersons said, look, we are for a unitary state, and I am also not very sure whether they really conceptualize unitary and united, you know, in the sense that we do in political science. But they said, we are for a unitary state. But we also want to say that after all, the provincial councils have worked under the present system, under a unitary state. So we are for the provincial councils. That's quite all right. Let's have the provincial councils. Right? Now this is a very important difference between the JVP and the JHU. Now if you sort of look at the political spectrum, starting from the JVP, then moving on to the JHU, and anybody else to further towards, let's call it left, would be much more pro-devolution then. You see, starting from the JHU. Because the Sri Lanka Freedom Party kind of, it has never had a very firm position on devolution. But still, it is most unlikely that if particularly Mr. Rajapaksa proposes a devolution package, his own rank and file will oppose it. That's not possible. The United National Party was for federalism, although a few months ago they kind of prevaricated on it because of domestic political considerations. And then at least what we call the mainstream Tamil parties are for devolution, not for separation. The point I'm making is this. If you take a parliament of 225 as it is today, apart from about 40 MPs, the others are for some kind of devolution. So the question arises, what kind of devolution are we talking about? Now that is where there is a debate. Because you can see from the all-party conference also that people have very quite significant different views as to what the devolution package should be. But at least here is the positive side. Because we need to operate in Sri Lanka in terms of, you know, taking into account a fairly realistic assessment of what is actually possible on the ground. People in general, again with the exception of the JVP, are strongly now supportive of making the provincial councils work. Now, you might say that the provincial councils are a very kind of, you see, wishy-washy kind of a devolution. But the fact of the matter is that even that wishy-washy model has not been properly implemented. Anybody who knows about Sri Lanka's provincial councils will know for a fact that the provincial councils have not been given even the powers that they should have. To give you one very pointed example, when Chandrika Kumaratunga became the chief minister of the Western Provincial Council, her first political office in Sri Lanka, she filed a case against the then government saying that she as the chief minister should have control over the police under the Provincial Council Act, under the 13th Amendment. Now, of course, she conveniently forgot that after she became president, but that's a different issue. But my point is that even the current Provincial Council Act has a lot of powers which can actually result in devolution. And with certain modification, it can be further strengthened. And that has not been done. So that one thing that one can do, if there is whatever some kind of a peace process is set in motion, is to seriously look at the provincial councils as a starting point. Why do we want to always start with what we think is the ideal perfect model? Because political evolution doesn't take place that way. Very often you start with the possible and then move towards something more idealistic. That's the way the world works, at least the way I see it. So, my argument is that there is potential for devolution. There is potential for bringing together not only the southern parties, but even some sections of the Tamil community and the Muslim community, who also subscribe to this kind of a perspective. Then, the next question I want to briefly comment on is, if the military campaign succeeds or whatever, if there is a peace process, apart from this whole issue of a devolution through, let's say, a revamped and a strengthened provincial council kind of devolution model for a start, what else can we do? Importantly, I come to Susan's point about human rights and various other things that one, the government can do, which will improve the situation. Because a lot of these issues are actually not even connected to the LTT's fight for a separate state or to even devolution. Human rights issues are very general issues. And so are so many other provisions. For example, language provisions. I mean, the country has been debating without, you know, I mean, endlessly about why Sri Lanka still can't implement the Sri Lankan language laws in the country. Because after all, I come from the central province. When I'm in Sri Lanka, I live in Kandy. Kandy is a very mixed community. That whole area is an ethnically mixed area. And there are constant complaints in the provincial council and the Kandy municipal council, which I closely follow, about the fact that there are no Tamil translators, there are no Tamil typewriters, there are no Tamil officers. We don't get a reply in Tamil. I mean, these are very mundane issues. You see, these have nothing to do with the war. But they definitely alienate the people who are victims of that situation. So that particular issue can be addressed. In other words, again, what is possible needs to be done. And finally, I comment on the issue of the Eastern Province and the Muslims. I looked at the CPA figures, which are available on the web, Center for Policy Alternatives, on these opinion polls, and what was striking was this. The Muslims are the people who are most supportive of stopping the war, more so than even the Tamils. 85% of the Muslims polled in a 1700 poll say the war must stop, peace negotiations must start. Among the Tamils who are, the sample is from the Eastern Province and Colombo, it's only about, you know, 67%. And among the Muslims, there is 42% say they are actually willing to, a significant number say they are even willing to trust Mr. Prabhakaran that he will actually be genuine in participating in the peace process. And among the Muslims, as I said, 85% want the war stopped, and 71%, the highest among the ethnic groups, 71% want an immediate political settlement to be negotiated, as opposed to 36% among the Sinhalese. So the Muslims have a very kind of a special situation, largely arising from their condition in the Eastern Province, where now they feel that they are kind of squeezed between the Sinhalese and the Tamils. That's what has happened. That is why the Eastern Province is so crucial to any kind of a long-term settlement. How do you come to some agreement on a political arrangement in the Eastern Province that will bring the Muslims and the Tamils and, of course, in Ampara, the Sinhalese together? And that is where, again, finally, in conclusion, one has to be creative. For instance, apart from the provincial councils, one has to think also of local government institutions. Because if you look at the demography of the Eastern Province, there is no one large area which is dominated by the Muslims. Because the Muslims are scattered. And therefore, they can be given more, powers of self-governance. to the Muslim communities if one is willing to strengthen the local government institutions together with the provincial councils. And those kinds of creative solutions need to be thought through if one is to think of a peaceful Sri Lanka. Thank you.
Thank you very much for a great presentation, Dr. Samarasinghe, and I'm sure everybody really appreciates, after my more dour assessments, recognizing some of the potentials and opportunities within the internal situation in Sri Lanka to address a political solution. Our next speaker is Ambassador Teresita Schaefer, who is currently the director of the South Asia Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, where she has served as resident expert on all things South Asia since 1998. Ambassador Schaefer came to CSIS after 30 years in the Foreign Service. From 1989 to 1992, she served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for South Asia, and from 92 to 95, she was U.S. Ambassador to Sri Lanka. Following this position, she served 2 years as Director of the Foreign Service Institute. Ambassador Schaefer has agreed to speak to us today about the international relations with Sri Lanka with regards to its conflict, and suitable actions the international community might take to positively impact the current situation.
Thank you, Susan, and it's always a pleasure to share a platform with Sam. There is something of an irony in my having been asked to talk about the international role in Sri Lanka, because I served as U.S. ambassador there at the time that there basically wasn't one. But maybe that gives me the detachment necessary to address the issue. There have basically been two periods when international people or factors were deeply involved in trying to move the peace process forward. The first of these was in the 1980s, and the people in question were, of course, the government of India. You had two rounds of negotiations in Thimphu, Bhutan, which became something of an iconic series of events, particularly from the point of view of the LTTE and more broadly of the Tamil community, which saw the positions that they had put forward at Thimphu as central to their concept of where a peace process needed to start. But after the two Thimphu sessions essentially went nowhere, you had a sharp turn for the worse, followed by two developments which also had profound impact on what followed. One was the Indo-Lanka Accord, the agreement under which Sri Lanka was to introduce constitutional change that included the beginnings of the devolution of power, and the Indian peacekeeping force, also provided for by the Indo-Lanka Accord, but which went to Sri Lanka thinking that it was going to have a nice, easy assignment of ratifying a peace agreement that was already made, and found itself in a shooting war primarily with the LTTE. This period ended unhappily in 1990 when the Sri Lankan government publicly invited the IPKF to leave, and the government of India eventually made sure they did that. The next period of serious international engagement started really in the late 1990s, when Norway began seriously looking for a role as a facilitator, helper — they didn't use the word mediator — in a Sri Lankan peace process that they hoped would get started. The ceasefire agreement that was signed in 2002 involved a great deal of Norwegian effort, although there were other quite different international influences on this process, as well as some domestic ones. This happened, of course, after the attacks on New York and Washington of 2001, and therefore it happened in an environment in which terrorism was very much more sharply demonized than had been the case in the past. the ceasefire agreement also happened after the LTTE's effort to take the Jaffna Peninsula, which stopped with the LTTE at the gates of Jaffna, when one speculates as to why they didn't get beyond the gates. The explanation that to me has made the greatest sense was that they had lost so much blood in carrying out 7 months of conventional warfare that they basically decided that they couldn't go on. So a blend of international and domestic factors that led to a ceasefire agreement, which in turn ushered in by far the most successful period of Sri Lankan peacemaking. Several meetings, all of them outside of Sri Lanka, culminating in one in Oslo, in which the Sri Lankan government and the LTTE agreed on a statement that included three magic words or magic phrases that had not been used before. That is, the quest for a federal solution in the context of one Sri Lanka and embodying internal self-determination. I will spare you the glossary of why these terms were important, but this was supposed to set the basic ground rules for the peace talks that followed. Unfortunately, within 3 or 4 months, those talks had broken down. For reasons that were, again, a blend of domestic problems and international missteps. But by this time, one additional international device had taken shape, and that was the institution of the co-chairs. I must confess that I never can remember what they were supposed to be co-chairs of. But they were Norway, the U.S., the EU, and Japan. And this formed an international club whose mission was to keep the focus on the peace process and try to keep all of the peace processors, including most importantly the government of Sri Lanka and the LTTE, focused on moving forward towards a more peaceful future. What we learned in the period following the breakdown of the peace process in 2003 was that the international co-chairs couldn't do this all on their own. They couldn't even do it with the very considerable help and skill of the Norwegian facilitators. And so you had an increasingly nasty environment. I remember visiting Sri Lanka in 2004 and being really quite stunned with the hostility towards Norway that had cropped up at that time. And then, of course, a year after that, there was the assassination of the Sri Lankan Foreign Ministry, Minister Lakshman Kadirgama, which I regard as the death of the ceasefire, even though the burial only took place within the past couple of months. As all of this was happening, as the ceasefire and the peace process were in their downward spiral, what suddenly came up again was a renewed flurry of interest in India as peace broker, including the rather remarkable argument that was made by some people that Norway had too many ulterior motives in the results in Sri Lanka, and that India would be more objective and wouldn't have its own agenda. I don't wish to sound as if I'm casting criticisms at anyone, but India is a very large neighbor which, in a sense, is entitled to have an agenda. If the United States were accused of having an agenda in Mexico, I would say, you're probably right. But what this tells you is that anyone internationally who is getting involved in this process is getting involved in Sri Lankan politics with all that that implies, including a measure of irrationality, which students of American and other politics would find quite familiar. What can we learn from all of this? Well, let me try out on you five lessons and a big question. The first lesson is that the most important variable at the end of the day is the commitment and the behavior of the people who actually need to make peace. The Sri Lankan government, the LTTE, more broadly, Sri Lankan society of whatever ethnic background. And in fact, the two periods when the peace process seemed to be doing fairly well, and one of these was with international help in 2002-2003, one of them was basically without international help in 1995, were both periods when it appeared that there was a strong commitment to peace. How strong that commitment was later open to question, but certainly there was a heady period of a few months in each case when it looked like everyone was actually trying to make something happen. Without that, you're not going to get anywhere. Second lesson is more complicated, and that is that there are advantages and disadvantages, if you're an international facilitator, to being deeply engaged in the region where peace is trying to be made. In principle, either model can work, and I think we've seen this in other places. The U.S. role in the Middle East comes to mind. Pure neutrality is a myth. Fairness, however, is achievable and is an essential requirement. But again, without that core commitment on the part of the would-be peacemakers, the best facilitation in the world isn't going to do you much good. And in that regard, the prize for the worst idea goes to the person, and I can't even remember who this was, who suggested that perhaps India and Norway could share the honors of peace brokering. You really can't do it with more than one. Third lesson has to do with the sequence. And here again, it's a lesson that is kind of a non-lesson. You can argue that it's better to tackle the easier issues first, and this is the principle on which the Sri Lankan peace process started to proceed in 2003. You can argue that you need to settle the core issues first, at least at some level of general principle, and that is basically what was attempted in this declaration in Oslo. Either argument in principle is very strong. What I conclude, though, is that you do need to show early in the process some evidence that both sides are willing to give something. That turns out to be difficult because the classic attitude with which countries or quasi-countries go into negotiations is that they have to be starting from a position of strength. And the efforts that countries will go through to protect that purported position of strength are tremendous and frequently will undercut the larger enterprise. Fourth lesson is that diffuse groups like co-chairs can help, but they have at best a supporting role. And in the case of the co-chairs in Sri Lanka, I think that looking back on their experience, they were fatally weakened by the fact that they really didn't have a way of making common cause with India, which after all was the large neighbor. India, for reasons of its own, was not at all interested in joining a club of other people that was trying to do something big in its neighborhood. India was not hostile to the effort. The Norwegians were punctilious about keeping them briefed, had a good equation with the Indian government. They were doing it right. But as long as it was possible to say, well, you've got these guys over here and these guys over here, it was going to be very hard to muster consistent international pressure in support of this larger enterprise. Finally, final lesson is not a particularly original one, but is worth remembering, and that involves the role of sanctions. Particularly during periods when the peace process wasn't working terribly well, a number of international players, very much including the United States, used sanctions as a way of making their positions known and as a way of trying to put pressure on the LTTE over whom they basically had no leverage. For the United States, the primary form of sanction was the list of state sponsors of terrorism and the list of terrorist organizations, which trigger a whole range of prohibitions on financial dealings, and which also, an organization that's on that list cannot have official talks with the U.S. government. It's a heavy stick, but once you've wielded it, you've wielded it, and you don't have a way of climbing back unless the other party has decided it's going to climb back. This turned out to be a limitation that ultimately made it impossible for the U.S. to have very much impact on the LTTE, unless they were in one of their phases of wanting to be internationally respectable. And there were a couple of those phases, but this was never a terribly strong motivation with them. The Europeans had somewhat more subtle and nuanced terrorism rules than the United States. Consequently, they were able to play the game for a little bit longer, except that ultimately, when the EU, quite appropriately in my view, put the LTTE on their terrorism list after the assassination of Mr. Kadergamer, then they were essentially in the same position. They had done their sanction. There was no other variable in play. That leaves me with the big question, and it's a big question that is sadly pertinent now, which is, what is the role of military force in the peacemaking process? The assumption of both the LTTE and the government at the moment appears to be that if we can have a military victory, that will solve our problem. It pains me to say this, but it may be true that a military victory is going to turn out to be a necessary ingredient in this peace process. I find that a painful conclusion to come to, or a painful question to raise, which would be more accurate, for lots of reasons, not the least of which is my great doubts as to whether either side is likely to be able to achieve a real military victory. But, and this is the really important point, even if you believe that a military victory, whatever that means, is a necessary ingredient, you still need a peace plan. And this is what makes me most anxious about the current situation in Sri Lanka, because I see a situation in which the two main military antagonists both are focusing on the war. They both believe they can win the war. I have deliberately not defined what winning the war means. One could argue over that for a long time. But I don't see the political plan up anybody's sleeve, the peace plan up anybody's sleeve, that would turn this hoped-for military victory into actual peace. And without that, all that fighting is just a lot more people dead, which is precisely the fate that I suspect everyone in this room would like to avoid in Sri Lanka. And I hope that some of the people in the audience will have a more concrete, short-term, good idea about how to get there.
Thank you very much. Before we get to the question-answer period and your opportunity to suggest good ideas for how to address the political situation, I am grateful that Ambassador Bernard Gunatilaka could join us today, and I would invite the ambassador to offer any comments he'd like to before we launch into question and answer, if you wouldn't mind just using the microphone over there.
Thank you, Susan. Thank you very much indeed. We were speaking today about the demise of the CFA. I have a particular fondness towards the CFA, at least for sentimental reasons. Most of the people within and outside Sri Lanka believe it was signed on 22nd February 2002. In fact, it was signed on 18th February 2002. And the signed agreement decided to take residence in my briefcase for 3 days until such time it was taken out in Kilinochi on the 22nd of February and handed over to the ambassador of Norway. You all know, I'm sure most of all you know, that negotiations with LTTE and the Tamil side went on for six different rounds, beginning 1985, 87, 89, 1994, 95, 2002, 2003, and 2006. And how these negotiations came to an end, we know. I don't want to go into detail. At least the 2002-2003 round, about which I have particular familiarity, I can say very much that there was optimism within Sri Lanka as well as outside that this time or that time it was going to succeed. By about January 2003, there was a feeling Sri Lankan peace process was the most successful peace process in the world. That was following the meeting that we had in Oslo in November 2002, at which point there was an agreement to have a federal solution within the United States, acceptable to all ethnic communities within, as Tessie said, internal self-determination. The important fact is what happened after coming, after reaching that agreement in 2002 November was the decision, important factor there was the decision taken to address certain important issues relating to the solution of the long-standing conflict. But unfortunately, when we met following that meeting, Oslo meeting, in the next round, about that was in Germany, followed by Hakone, we tried to persuade the LTTE to discuss the substantive issues. There were 6 points to be taken out to be discussed one by one. And in Hakone, in Japan, we took up the first issue. By mutual agreement, that was human rights issues. And unfortunately, at that point, when the international advisor on human rights came up with a particular paper as to how both parties should adhere to the human rights conditions, there was a response from the LTTE saying, no, we are not ready to have international supervision on international human rights situation. LTTE is not ready for it. And of course, he went on to say, in Sri Lanka, where we have local institutions, and those local institutions are good enough for us to observe human rights. The fact was, we came to know later that the LTTE had an afterthought following the November meeting in Oslo that the decision to go for a federal solution was not a sound idea. And in fact, we later came to know that they faltered Anton Balasingham, the leader of the LTTE delegation, for agreeing to that that kind of an arrangement. And when he visited Sri Lanka and Vanni following that meeting, there was a disagreement, there was a dispute. He came to Sri Lanka for a week's stay, and within 2 days he decided to turn back and go back to the United Kingdom. So we knew that there was a fundamental difficulty on the part of the LTTE to go along the proposal that was decided in Oslo in November 2002. We also heard the developments that took place which led to the end of the CFA. In fact, it was Tercy who said that the TFA, the funeral of the TFA, was the killing of Foreign Minister Kadragama. But in fact, if that was the funeral, the death of Kadragama was the initial step. Actually, the funeral took place, most probably I can say, on December 5th or December 6th of 2005, that is 5 or 6 months after minister's death. This is following the presidential election and following the statement made by Mr. Prabhakaran on 27th of November 2005, where he said, we recognize newly elected president as a pragmatic man. We would give him time to solve the problem. And that was 27th and 6th of December, that was less than 10 days later, the first attack against the Navy convoy took place, followed by a series of attacks, followed by an attack in the marketplace in Trincomalee, and followed by another attack against the army commander in the headquarters of the army by a suicide bomber, followed by another Claymore attack which killed nearly 60 people in a bus in the North Central Province, and subsequent events. So we see that although there was an undertaking given by the leader of the LTT in November 2005 that he would give time for the government to come up with a solution, it appears that LTT itself had a strategy, a formula to achieve their objective, which basically shortly to blockade the port of Trincomalee, which would resupply the Jaffna Peninsula, and then attack the Jaffna Peninsula, which they did on 11th of August with the intention of taking over the Jaffna Peninsula. And the game plan, we believe, we have good reasons to believe so, was to, after getting through to the Jaffna Peninsula, to declare what we call the UDI, Unilateral Declaration of Independence. This time about, unlike in the previous, I think in the previous, there were previous instances where there were withdrawal, like the attack against army camp in Elephant Pass. The troops fought back and made it known to the LTT that they will not be able to achieve their military objective, and which followed by the attacks or confrontations with the LTT in the Eastern Province until such time. By July last year, the LTT was evicted from that from the Eastern Province. There was also a reference to the military strategy or the military victory as well as political solution. In fact, if you look at the statement made by President Rajapaksa on 25th of November 2005, he made it very clear that his intention was to grant maximum possible devolution within a united country. And that statement he reiterated in several places, including in New York a year or 2 years ago. And with regard to the military solution, there seems to be a position expressed by many government is heading towards a military decision, but military victory rather than a political solution. This is despite the assurances given by the president. And in fact, 2-3 days ago, the commander of the Sri Lanka army very clearly said there will be no military solution to the problem. A solution to the problem will be political, but his job is to confront the LTT wherever it is necessary, so that there will be no idea in the mind of the LTT that they will be able to achieve the kind of victory they are seeking for, to have a separate state in the northern and eastern part of the country. So when the international community tell us that you should look for a political solution and there is you cannot go for a military solution, all what we can say is you exactly tell say what we believe, and our intention is also to seek a political solution. And as Sam said a little while ago, there we expect there will be a solution leading, or at least proposals leading to a political solution in the coming days, maybe within a week or 10 days' time. Expectation is by 23rd or 24th, they will take the first step towards in that direction. And there was also a reference to the fact that if there is any leader in Sri Lanka who could bring a political solution to the country, that is President Mahinda Rajapaksa. I entirely agree with it, for the simple reason there seemed to be a belief on the part of the people in the south that this man will not undersell any particular community. Therefore, we have trust in him and that he will bring peace and solution to the conflict. And we certainly hope with the forthcoming proposals for a negotiated settlement, President will be able to achieve that objective. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ambassador. We have a few minutes now, and I want to invite all of you to provide some questions and answers. And if you just come up to the microphone here, exactly, and you can line up if you'd like to, and just be sure to tell us your name and your affiliation. Thanks.
I'm Raghuveer Goyal from India Globe in Asia Today. It was a great presentation, all of you, including Ambassador. My question is that, one, can you compare this Sri Lanka conflict with any conflict around the globe going on so many? And second, to run such terrorist campaign or the government, they need funds. Like, who's supporting the government as far as the military, or who's supporting the militants as far as the money or financially or any weapons distribution or supply?
Well, there are several other conflicts that have gone on just as long, and you can argue about which is more intense, but certainly Israel and the Palestinians have been going at it for a long time. At the moment, you don't have a high-intensity conflict in Kashmir, but certainly the dispute has gone on for even longer. As far as the cost is concerned, it doesn't cost all that much to run an organization like the LTTE, and they've had a very efficient method of collecting money from expatriate Tamils. The government's efforts, it's a little bit more complicated to measure in the case of the government. The military expenditures have certainly gone up in recent years, which is something that the country has had to pay for with the rest of the economy, and international assistance has mostly been directed towards the economy.
Thank you. My name is Eleftherios Michael with American University. My question to you is, what do you think the United States can do to assist the two sides to go back to the negotiation table? And a linked question to that is, can the U.S., India, the North, Japan, or someone else assist on this? Or is that kind of a missed opportunity to get all these sides together back again?
That's exactly what the co-chairs have been trying to do, actually, for as long as they've been in existence. In Sri Lanka, the United States has never had a central role in the international efforts to resolve the basic question. The U.S. has been a supporting player rather than a central one. And I think that's still the case. The players with a more central role have been, at various times, India, at various other times, Norway, and the other supporting cast, so to speak, have been Japan, the EU, mainly those. And within the EU, I think that the Netherlands has had a somewhat higher profile. But my view is that these countries can all help. They have tried to use their economic assistance as leverage, but they have found themselves with more leverage on one side than on the other. They all have relations with the government of Sri Lanka. They all have aid budgets there. They've found themselves with relatively little ability to influence the LTTE. And at the end of the day, they can't do it unless both sides have concluded that the peace effort is going to gain more for them than the military effort. That was a conclusion that everyone had reached in 1995 and that everyone had reached in 2001, 2002, 2003. I fear that both sides at this point think they have more to gain in the short term by a successful military effort.
But probably Sri Lanka government has a lot to gain by presenting a credible post-war conflict solution package, particularly to convince India that India should strongly back the settlement and whatever leverage that the Indians have, particularly through Tamil Nadu on the LTT, could be exercised. It's for that reason that failure on the part of the Sri Lanka government to come up with a credible set of proposals will actually be will undermine their own campaign. So I personally think that that's important. And as for Mr. Rajapaksa, see, I'm always reminded of the parallel with Mr. Sharon of in Israel, because Mr. Rajapaksa politically is better placed in the Sri Lankan political spectrum to push for a solution which will be perhaps acceptable to at least significant segments of the minority communities that other southern political leaders can't deliver. Because after all, you see, the moment a package is, say, like the CFA was presented, immediately there is the local political thing kicking in and trying to undermine it. Whereas Mr. Rajapaksa luckily is placed in that position where he can outflank, you see, the opposition to a reasonable package, a political package.
Hi, Ivan Sigal. I'm a fellow here at USIP. I have a question, Susan, about the humanitarian community. You mentioned that they've been receiving increased pressure and threats and lessened security. What is the humanitarian community doing now? With the expectation that there will be increased conflict, and what is the UN doing, both as a precursor to increased conflict and also within the negotiation process, UN OSHA and others?
As you may have seen, there was a statement that was released today by a series of humanitarian NGOs operating in Sri Lanka, actually Sri Lankan NGOs, who expressed concern about the scrutiny of the particularly international NGOs in Sri Lanka. So there's this sort of rallying and drawing attention to the situation and the concerns about the scrutiny and the threats that are coming in the face of current events. We'll see where that leads. Hopefully it will, having greater attention to it, will put some pressure to kind of relieve some of the, particularly I think some of the propaganda-like accusations against NGOs that they're biased towards the LTTE, which is the kind of popular criticism of the NGOs. In terms of the UN, recent attention has been primarily focused around UNHCR and or UNHCHR, sorry, and the potential to create a monitoring body or to open an office in Sri Lanka, which has generally been resisted. With UNICEF and some of the other UN agencies in Sri Lanka, they've been facing some of the same scrutiny. And again, international attention, drawing attention to the situation and trying to both work with the government to demonstrate commitment to addressing some of the accusations against the agencies who are operating there, I think could potentially lead to greater independence for them to operate and being able to really bring assistance to the areas that are facing a lot of the military campaigns right now.
Colonel Dutta, Foreign Policy Association. My question is regarding LTT acquiring a small air force. Could somebody throw some light on the tactical as well as the strategic implications of acquiring this small air force? I would request His Excellency the Ambassador of Sri Lanka could do it, or the former ambassador.
Well, first of all, the accent is on the word small. A couple of aircraft. This isn't something that in a larger country like India or the United States would be considered strategic. But it does have strategic significance in the Sri Lankan context because it has made it possible for the LTTE to mount aerial attacks on, for example, Colombo's main civilian airport and the military base that's associated with it. It has extended the government's vulnerability in a very substantial way. What you're dealing with here, though, fundamentally, is asymmetrical warfare. You have a government which, like all governments, has a whole country to govern and to defend, and for which any successful attack represents, in some sense, a defeat. You have a small force, I don't know how small, but certainly smaller than the army, which has the ability to train and prepare for one big event. If that one big event doesn't come off, they can train and prepare for another big event. Somebody from the Irish Republican Army was quoted once. I don't know whether this was actually said, but the quotation was, "Mrs. Thatcher has to be lucky every time. We only have to be lucky once." That's the phenomenon you're dealing with, and that makes it peculiarly difficult for the government. On the other hand, whenever you hear from the LTTE or from members of the Tamil community who believe that the LTTE is being unfairly stigmatized, one of the arguments that's made is that the Sri Lankan government has all the advantages that go with being a government. Their maintaining military force is considered to be legitimate, whereas the LTTE's doing so is questioned around the world. So you win some, you lose some. But in terms of what they are trying to gain and what they stand to lose, this is a kind of conflict in which the larger power is also the more vulnerable one.
Yes, a follow-up question.
You've got two people behind you.
Would it escalate the present conflict, the acquisition of the LTTE of this few aircraft? Would it escalate?
I would say it already has.
If we could have both of you offer your questions, and we'll try to tackle both of them with the few minutes we have left.
Raja Gundu, CSIS. The question is, in the Sri Lankan army has been focusing on taking out the LTTE's leadership. Now, this seems to work as a military objective. But from a political standpoint, what does the Sri Lankan government believe that after winning the war, who do they see actually coming to the table on behalf of the Tamils if the LTTE leadership is assuming it's taken out completely?
You could have your question as well. Try to address both of them.
I have a comment and a question. I'm Elias J. Raja, Tamil American from North Carolina. I did not hear a lot about the recent happenings over there where the Amnesty International and the Human Rights Watch have said more than 3,000 disappearances has happened mainly in the totally government-controlled areas of Jaffna Peninsula and the government-controlled areas of the capital, Colombo. And almost all the victims were Tamils, and it's suspected it was done by the government forces and their paramilitaries that they are supporting them. And also, we talked about what was the death knell on the peace process, and different speakers gave different incidents for that. In my view, actually, as far as the Tamils are concerned, it happened with right after the tsunami. So we know that after the tsunami, there were like two parallel conflicts, one in Sri Lanka and one in Aceh, but there was this peace agreement brought about because of the goodwill of the Indonesian people reaching out to the Aceans, and we had a successful conclusion of that conflict. Whereas that opportunity was dearly missed in Sri Lanka. I was part of an organization trying to send relief supplies to northern eastern part of Sri Lanka, and we had to undergo a lot of obstacles to that. Our medical aid was confiscated by the government of Sri Lanka when my congressman called Ambassador Gunatilaka's office to try to clear one of the shipments. He was told that it's a holiday today in Sri Lanka and we cannot talk about that. That's the kind of attitude that we have seen then. And all over the Tamil diaspora encountered that we could. They were putting all kinds of taxes. We ourselves paid a lot of taxes to clear tsunami relief supplies, and we couldn't even help our own people. And the question that I have is that you all suggested that, especially Ambassador Schaefer, suggested that there may be a military solution, may be a necessary ingredient for a peace process to take hold. I would like to know her opinion that what will you advise in case it ends up in a stalemate, or in fact the military solution ends up in the opposite direction where the Tamil side takes an upper hand. Thank you.
Did you want to tackle one of these?
Yes, please. If you permit me to do so, this is with reference to the confiscation of the medical supplies that was sent. He was partly right and partly wrong. There was no confiscation. There was a detention at the port, not by the government of Sri Lanka, but by the handling agent who demanded that X amount of dollars should be paid to him to release the shipping documents. So it was, we had nothing to do with, government had nothing to do with it, and poor Ambassador Gunatilaka had to pay the money from his personal resources so that the documents could be released and the medical supplies could be sent to the destination. Thank you.
Let me try to tackle some of them, and then I imagine that Professor Samarasinghe will also have something to say. The three questions that were posed were about Tamil leadership, disappearances, actually it's four, the tsunami experience, and what about military victory, and let me try to tackle them very briefly in turn. I don't know what the answer is to your question about who would provide leadership if the current leadership of the LTTE is gone. The reason that the government has been focusing on negotiating with the LTTE was that more than any other Tamil organization, this was the organization that had the power to prevent a settlement. By extension, if they could be brought on board, they might have the power to make a settlement happen. My own concern about the decapitation strategy is exactly that, that at the end of the day you're going to need a political strategy and you're going to need someone who can sell it. But I don't have a good answer to that. Disappearances have been one of the tragic features of the two civil wars in Sri Lanka, stretching back over 25 years and more. The figures you cite are truly horrifying. But I would have to say that human rights violations generally are one of the tragic features of the conflicts in Sri Lanka, and again, it's conflicts plural. I think that there are many people in a position of responsibility who have a lot to answer for, and that includes bombings of civilian facilities, assassinations of politicians of many different communities, individual assassinations, probably more often of Tamil figures. This is the best possible reason to want to end the war. The tsunami does indeed represent a tragically missed opportunity. I would distribute the blame for that a little bit more broadly than our questioner did. when the government and the LTTE tried to negotiate an arrangement under which some portion of the relief funds could be directly administered by the people who lived in the affected areas, they came up with something that the American cartoonist Rube Goldberg would have been proud of. It was the most complicated arrangement I've ever heard of it. And then it was, I would say, rather mischievously submitted to the courts, which threw out an obscure part of it and therefore made the whole thing not work. So I would agree with you that that was a bad day for tsunami relief and a bad day for Sri Lankan political progress. The final question on the role of a military solution. I want to be very clear that I was asking a question rather than making the statement about a military victory maybe being a necessary ingredient. But as far as my recommendation is concerned, I've been very consistent on that for years. I think this conflict needs to be negotiated. I think it will need to be negotiated no matter what happens on the military front. I think that's where you can find the ingredients in peace.
Just a couple of brief comments, starting with the Bandashe comment. There is a difference between Bandashe and Sri Lanka. In the case of Bandashe, actually the tsunami terribly weakened the rebel movement there. They were destroyed, they themselves, so that the physical presence of the Friyashe movement was weakened. Whereas in Sri Lanka, there is no evidence of that. But at the same time, I do agree with the ambassador that there is no question that the Sri Lankan, the tsunami gave Sri Lanka an opportunity and we missed. Because the first couple of months in Sri Lanka, the Sri Lankans behaved like Sri Lankans. Because for a long time, we had forgotten what to be Sri Lankans. We were Sinhalese, Tamils, Muslims, and so on. And after the tsunami, we were Sri Lankans, but unfortunately, there was not the leadership that the nation required at that point in time to make an opportunity out of it. And therefore, we slid back. And by the time the Pitons Agreement was mooted in June of 2005, it was too late. And after that, we had got back to the old arguments, and tsunami was sort of very much in the background. As for this issue of disappearances, I totally agree with the speaker, the person who raised the question, that there is no question. I mean, human rights violations are human rights violations. In fact, I personally believe that good governance is a part of the broader solution. And in the Sri Lankan case, that is very weak now. Let's face it. I mean, you know, from elections to so many other areas of governance, I mean, look at the police extrajudicial killings that are taking place, which go reported. The Sri Lankan media, say the electronic media, in the evening, main evening news broadcast, very casually says that the police reported that in such and such a place, two people were arrested. They are local underworld figures and they were taken to such and such a place around 12 midnight. Because they said that there was a gun hidden somewhere, and then when they were taken there, they suddenly wanted to shoot the policeman who accompanied them, or wanted to throw a hand grenade or something, and in self-defense they were shot dead. I mean, the whole story is, you see, I mean, silly, basically. And this has been going on for the last 2.5-3 years. And these are extremely serious issues. And these are connected to this larger question, and these cannot be taken in isolation. And as for the leadership issue, I agree. Don't forget that the Sinhalese leadership in my generation has also been decimated in Sri Lanka as a result of the conflict. Because I am not even sure that we would have had the present president or even the previous presidents if the Sri Lankan leadership that, you know, after all, in every generation, there will be a certain number of political leaders, certain number of good lawyers, surgeons, etc., etc. And in the case of Sri Lanka, the leadership has been decimated by the conflict over the last 25 to 30 years. And this is true for the Tamil community as much as for the Sinhalese community. And so the question arises, what would you do if the government succeeds in doing what the LTT has done to the Tamil leadership and the Sinhalese leadership? That's the question, actually. So that, you know, the entire leadership is gone, whether it is militant or non-militant and so on. And I suppose the answer is that you will have a second-rate leadership. Thank you.
Well, with that, We have gone well over, but this is a testament to the complex situation that we're dealing with and the big questions we're tackling. I want to thank my presenters for giving their insightful presentations today, and thanks to all of you for coming.
Well, Susan, thank you for being here.
Yeah, thank you for participating. That was great.
Courtney with a dress. Unfortunately, not dressed enough.